ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Prices shift, petrol jumps, shares fall. A company cuts jobs, and suddenly the business story is everyone's story.
I'm Alan Kohler.
And I'm Carrington Clark. From Monday to Thursday on ABC Business Daily, we break down the biggest stories in business, finance, and the economy, and why they matter.
Then on Fridays, I'll go deeper on That's Business, the people making decisions, taking risks, and shaping where the economy goes next.
Find it all in the ABC Business Daily feed on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. G'day, Matt Bevan here. This is If You're Listening. If there's one type of story that I love, and I wish we could cover more on this show, it's ones about micronations. The stories of people who plant their feet, say, I've had enough, my backyard is now the sovereign nation of New Backyardia. On last week's episode, we looked at one particular micronation, the State of Free Lebanon, an unrecognised, relatively short-lived Israeli puppet state. It got me thinking about my all-time favourite plucky underdog micronation. It's called Sealand, and when I mentioned it briefly in an episode last year, a lot of you wrote in to express that you shared my enthusiasm. So, here we are. Today, I'm finally telling the story of the radio pirate turned actual pirate who declared himself the prince of a rusting gun platform in the North Sea. I'm joined again by producer Adair Shepherd. Hi, Adair.
Hello. Yes, we got a lot of emails about this. There's a lot of Sealand fans amongst the If You're Listeners.
So, Adair, have you seen the movie The Boat That Rocked from 2009?
Yes. Bill Nighy. I love that movie.
I hate that movie.
Oh, no.
The thing was, I didn't hate the movie while watching it. I mean, I did a little bit. It's an interesting movie. It's based on pirate radio, and it's based on these guys being off the coast of the UK, broadcasting rock music into the UK illegally.
Yeah.
The problem with it is that there's no plot, right?
Mm.
It's kind of like, isn't it cool that there were these pirate radio guys, and then there's a storm and the boat sinks, and that's the whole plot of the story.
That's true.
But the reason I hate this movie is because the amount of drama that there actually was between the pirate radio stations was extraordinary.
Okay.
And they didn't use any of it, any of the true stories of pirate radio. So I'm going to tell you
okay.
a true story of pirate radio.
What the boat that rocked should have been. Okay, I'm excited.
And the premise of the story is true in that people were really, really annoyed about the fact that other parts of the world had rock commercial radio.
Why didn't they have it?
Basically because the BBC had a full monopoly on radio broadcasts. There was no other broadcaster in the UK.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it was illegal to have another radio station in the UK. And so, because it's Europe, various people in the UK would listen to radio coming from the mainland and coming from these illegal offshore radio broadcasters who were broadcasting from boats with big transmitters on top of them parked out in the ocean. Now, those boats were problematic and kind of really difficult to live on, difficult to broadcast from. And so off the coast of the Thames, so if you can imagine London, you know, is on the Thames River. Mm-hmm. The Thames runs east and then it dumps out into the North Sea in kind of a bay area. And in that bay, during World War II, the British were really concerned that the Germans would come and blockade the Thames and stop boats from coming in and out of the Thames. And so they developed these things called Maunsell forts, which are basically giant concrete structures made of prefabricated concrete that they made on land, and they would float out into the Thames estuary and then basically pull plugs in the bottom of them. They would sink and then sit on the sandbed of the Thames estuary. So it was basically two giant concrete columns with a platform on top, mm-hmm. and you could put guns on the top of the platform and stop anybody from being able to come into the Thames Estuary area and mess around with them at all.
Sure. Seems like a great solution.
It was a good solution.
Yeah.
And because there were these giant things, these were basically seven-story buildings.
Mm-hmm.
They had quarters for like 150 Navy personnel. And after World War II, they had no need for these forts anymore and they abandoned them.
Mm-hmm.
So these forts became of interest to the pirate radio broadcasters who wanted to be able to use them.
And not be seasick.
And not be seasick and not accidentally sink and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so there were four of these forts and a bloke named Paddy Roy Bates decided that he was going to commandeer one of those forts and set up a radio station on it, which he called Radio Essex.
We're situated on the Knockjohn ex-naval fort in the, or just outside the Thames estuary, about approximately 12 miles from Southend, and we are the most seaward fort of them all. And believe me, sometimes we know it. When first seen from the sea, is from, very similar to that of a battleship. So that's what we call it, the old battleship. That's enough about the fort. Our power, well, that's a state secret. Our staff consists, our DJ staff.
So, I mean, it's pretty loose content, I think you'll agree.
Very loose, yes.
Yeah. I mean, but you've got to remember this is just a bunch of dudes. They would have to go out on a boat to these forts.
They didn't live on the fort.
No, they did live on the fort. They had to live out there because it was such a nightmare to get back to shore.
Okay.
But these were just pop music enthusiasts. They would often just be bringing their own record collection.
That's great.
And playing it. Like the radio station didn't have its own record collection. It was just the DJs brought their own things and played them on their show.
Yeah,
it was very loose. So the thing was that the British government made it clear that they were not going to allow this. And the problem that they had was three of the four forts were technically in British territorial waters.
Aha.
And the ones that were on British territorial waters were the ones that were most easy to get to from the shore because they were quite close to the shore.
Yes.
Only one of the four forts was actually in international waters. It had been placed there illegally during World War II. It was against the law for the British government to do what they did, but, you know, it was World War II and so who cares. But nobody really wanted to go there because it was so far out in the ocean.
Yeah.
But one of the radio stations, Radio Caroline, went and set up on Fort Ruffs, and Paddy Roy Bates, the owner of Radio Essex, decided that he wanted that fort. Thank you very much. And so he rocked up with his son on Christmas Eve 1966 when they thought that there wouldn't be very many people from Radio Caroline on the fort.
Yeah.
They went in there. They made it clear that it was theirs now. They didn't actually beat them up, but they kind of made it clear that they would be.
Yeah,
They would regret it if they didn't leave the fort. So the folks from Radio Caroline left the fort, and from Christmas Eve 1966, Bates had control of this tower and started broadcasting from this tower from Christmas Eve 1966.
I do know one thing about Radio Caroline.
Oh, yes.
The guy who created Radio Caroline, Ronan O'Reilly, he was the manager for George Lazenby, who was the Australian James Bond. And he's the person who convinced George Lazenby to quit after one James Bond film because apparently James Bond was going nowhere.
Tremendous call.
Yeah.
Because, George Lazenby didn't have a massive career after James Bond.
No.
So the thing was that the fort was extremely attractive to the other radio stations. They really wanted it. Basically, they needed to literally fight in order to retain control of the fort. Michael, so this is Paddy Roy Bates's 14-year-old son at the time, was left on the fort on his own to literally hold the fort.
No.
On several occasions.
Oh, my God.
To make sure that nobody took the fort off them.
What?
He was given a gun.
No.
And the materials to make Molotov cocktails. And so whenever a boat that he suspected of being hostile came near the fort, he would fire warning shots.
Oh, my God.
And
And
lob Molotov cocktails at them into the ocean. Never, they would say, with the intention of actually harming anybody.
Sure.
Basically just to tell them to go away.
But it's a 14-year-old boy with Molotov cocktails.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So Bates had kind of more ideas for the fort than just pirate radio. And as kind of semi as a joke, on his wife's birthday the following year in 1967, he declared the creation of the Principality of Sealand, what he described as a sovereign nation on this fort.
Yes.
Which he would be the prince of, his wife would be the princess, and his son would be another prince, and the family would be the royal family of the Principality of Sealand. Nobody really paid much attention to this. Everyone kind of thought it was a bit ridiculous. They sent in sort of attempts to basically register themselves as a country with other countries. The thing was that there is kind of a vague framework for what constitutes as a country.
Yes, okay.
Which was set by the Montevideo Convention. And it's pretty questionable exactly how much legal weight this convention has, but it's kind of used as sort of a four-point checklist for is this a country or not.
Okay.
And the four-point checklist goes, does it have a permanent population? Does it have a defined territory that is not part of another country?
Mm-hmm.
Does it have a government, and does it have the capacity to enter into relations with other states?
So they've checked off quite a few of those.
Well, kind of. They've kind of got a permanent population in that, you know, they're leaving a 14-year-old boy on there.
Yeah, exactly.
And sometimes there are radio DJs broadcasting from the tower. They've got a government. It's a one-person government, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
But they started sort of printing stamps and making banknotes just for fun.
Great.
The question is whether this was a defined territory that is not part of another country, not part of another jurisdiction.
Well, it's in international waters, right?
Yeah. But, you know, it was a fort that was placed there by the British Navy. So is that part of the UK was the question.
Mm.
So on the 6th of May 1968, Michael, the 14-year-old boy, did one of the things where he was firing guns and lobbing Molotov cocktails at people.
Yeah.
And the British government decided they weren't entirely on board with the fact that this was happening, and they arrested Michael and Roy on firearms offences. They were taken to the mainland and put on trial. But the thing was, the judge in the trial said, before we actually have the trial, we need to establish jurisdiction. And after they heard from all the parties, they decided that the British government's jurisdiction did not extend to the fort.
Wow.
And so, therefore, there was no trial.
Yeah.
Because apparently there was no law that prohibited people from firing guns and lobbing Molotov cocktails off the edge of this fort in international territory.
Wow, okay.
And so that was a big tick for them, that they were basically saying, okay, look, we own this fort. We can do what we like with it. They did apply to the United Nations and say, can we please be a member of the United Nations? A UN spokesperson responded with, the United Nations is an organization of governments, not gun platforms. The Secretary General has a nut file for such applications.
Done. Okay.
So things on the fort got interesting over the next decade. The BBC created BBC Radio 1, which is their equivalent of Triple J, basically. Mm-hmm. And so they were broadcasting legal rock music on the mainland, and they poached a lot of the DJs from
Pirate Radio. Oh,
the Pirate Radio stations to come and be on Radio 1, and kind of that was the end of Pirate Radio.
Wow.
They also then subsequently allowed commercial broadcasting in the early 1970s, and so commercial radio stations, legal commercial radio stations, started propping up on the mainland. There was really no need for pirate radio. And so what is the point of this platform now, and how are they going to make any money out of it, and how are they going to keep it above water, you might say?
Very good.
The Bates family, Paddy and Michael, were very determined to hold on to it because they kind of saw it as this family project now.
Mm.
They spent the next decade trying to make the new nation more livable, even though the fact it had no electricity, no water, no communication with the outside world.
No communication?
No. I mean, it was far enough off the coast that they didn't really have, like, good CB radio. They could communicate kind of over ham radio, but it was basically they communicated via trips on the boat to the mainland.
Yeah, wow.
And, you know, Michael,
poor Michael,
remembers being left on the platform for weeks on end.
Oh, my God.
To try and make it more livable. They sort of started to create, you know, kitchen spaces, living quarters in the two turrets and sort of making it a bit more survivable.
Have you seen any, like, photos of the interior? Or
there's heaps of photos of what it looks like. It looks pretty horrible. It looks pretty dreadful.
Okay.
I mean, it looks like what it is, an abandoned naval facility.
Yeah. I just can't get over Michael.
Like, well, he was into it. He was into it.
Okay.
You know, it was kind of a thing that he did with his dad, you know?
I guess so.
And occasionally threw Molotov cocktails.
Yeah, but then 2 weeks by himself.
So in the mid-1970s, a German fellow named Professor Alexander Achenbach became interested in the platform and started speaking to Roy about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
He was a con man.
He
was not a professor. He had a, you know, a string of pretty questionable business activities in his past. But he started producing slick brochures, sort of proposing an expansion of Sealand by building out additional platforms around the existing platform of Sealand, which, by the way, is the size of two tennis courts, roughly.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The size of the country is the size of two tennis courts. So he was going to expand it so that they could have a golf course, that they could have oil refinery on there, hotels, a casino, all that kind of thing.
Wow.
They kind of weren't really going anywhere with it. And the Bates family were kind of like, you know, a bit skeptical about the whole thing. So Achenbach decided to launch a coup. Yeah.
Okay.
So Achenbach lured Roy, the dad, to Austria for a meeting, leaving Michael on the...
Poor Michael.
leaving Michael on the platform again.
I guess he's an adult by this
point.
Yeah,
yeah. But he's
still,
like 28.
Yeah.
Leaving Michael on the platform. While Roy was away, a helicopter approaches and it's Achenbach's lawyer.
Interesting.
And Achenbach's lawyer lands on the platform and says to Michael, oh, man, it's been quite a journey and, you know, rappelling down from a helicopter was pretty crazy. Can me and my friends who have come with me, you know, Achenbach's team,
okay,
can we come and just hang out for a little bit and would that be all right? Michael's like, I'd much rather my dad was here. I don't know why you're here without him. And, you know, I thought that this whole meeting was happening in Austria. I'd really rather it if you left.
He's got good instincts. Come on, Michael.
They went, look, can we have a whiskey before we go? So okay. Michael goes off into the bowels of the platform to the whiskey room. I don't know.
Okay, yeah.
He goes into the room where they have all the whiskey. And the Germans who have landed there go after him, shut the door behind him and lock it.
No.
So he's locked in the whiskey room.
Okay.
They basically said, look, you've got two options. One, we're going to lock you in here and you won't be able to get out until basically we figure out what to do with you. Or we would be happy to take you to the mainland, you know, basically just bugger off, get off the platform. Michael went, okay, fine, just take me to the mainland and we'll figure out what we're going to do.
Yeah.
So he gets dumped in Belgium, I think, without his passport.
Oh.
And he manages to find his way back to the UK and go back to, like, the house that the family owns. And Roy's there and he's like, we got coup d'etat.
Oh.
And Roy and Michael decide that they're going to take the platform back.
Oh, my God. Of course.
Now, they know a guy who flies helicopters for the James Bond franchise.
There's two James Bond connections. Okay.
Look, to be honest with you, Adair, I think in the 70s, a pretty large proportion of the British arts industry was devoted to making James Bond movies.
Sure. Okay.
I think they were a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
They get a lift to the platform. They approach the platform from downwind, so that the people on the platform won't hear them coming. They drop a rope from the helicopter. Michael slides down. There is one of the Germans is on the platform, but he's asleep on a chair.
Oh, okay.
Michael slides down on a rope and drops to the ground on the platform. He drops a bit harder than he expected to, and he kind of puts his hands down on the ground on the platform. And this leads to the shotgun in his hand going off. Bang.
Oh, okay.
It's fine.
Okay, okay.
The shotgun just fires off into the sky.
Yes.
But the Germans who are on the platform are like, whoa, okay, these people are serious. We give up. We're, you know, platform's yours.
Oh, okay.
No blood. No blood was spilled. It was basically like, okay, you've surprised us on the platform. You've got a gun. You can have it back.
That's it. I'm good. Okay.
Michael and Roy decided to let everyone go except for the lawyer, Achenbach's lawyer. They took him hostage on the platform.
Oh, I was on their side, but I don't know about that.
Well, when I say they took him hostage, I don't think they tied him up. They were just like, you're here now until we can get Achenbach to say sorry for what he did.
Okay.
But they made it clear that he wasn't allowed to leave.
Yeah. Okay.
Now we have a situation where you have a German national being held on a unrecognized micronation.
Yes.
The German government finds out about this. They call up the UK government and go, I believe that one of our citizens is being held hostage on a naval platform. the UK government basically went, it's been made very clear to us that this is not our problem. Would not like to get involved in this at all. Thank you very much. That nutbag out there can do what he likes.
Yeah.
It's got nothing to do with us. And
oh my God.
So the Germans then send a member of the German diplomatic corps, a diplomat,
oh, wow.
to Sealand to negotiate
oh my God.
The release of the hostage. Now, what is the significance of this, Adair?
It is the final point, the capacity to enter in relations with other countries.
Yes!
Oh my God!
So the Bates family considers this to be the final piece of the puzzle.
That's amazing.
Of finally making Sealand a legitimate country. They now have a permanent population, a defined territory that is not part of another country, a government, and the capacity to enter into relations with other states.
That's incredible.
So there you go. Bibbidi-bobbidi-boo. Now, to be clear, it's only them that thinks that.
Yes.
No other country has ever recognised Sealand. Okay. But Sealand does still exist.
Oh, yeah.
Roy died a little bit more than 10 years ago. Michael is now the Prince of Sealand.
Does he live there?
No, he doesn't live there. But members of the family, there is still a permanent population. People do live on the thing. Because they've kind of been able to sort of make a little bit of money out of it, basically by selling joke titles, joke passports. You can pay money and be a Lord of Sealand and that kind of thing.
Okay. How much money?
I can't remember what it was. A bit too much for a joke.
Too much for a joke. Okay.
Fast forward to 1997. Mm. Gianni Versace gets assassinated by a strange fellow.
Yes.
Andrew Cunahan, who had already murdered four other men. They go to Cunahan's house and they look in his possessions. They find a Sealand passport.
Oh, wow.
And they go, oh, what's this?
Yeah.
And the people on Sealand kind of went, we don't want to be involved in that.
Yeah.
And so it's been kind of a tricky thing for them over the years.
So have they stopped selling passports?
They declared all passports at the time invalid and now they've wound back the passport business.
Okay, good on them. That's good.
A bit less funny than it used to be.
Yes.
But anyway, that is essentially the story of Sealand.
That's incredible.
And they're still bobbing along, although not technically bobbing, I suppose. They are stuck to the ground out there.
No, that's amazing. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I'm glad I know more about Sealand than just that Pirate Bay tried to buy it.
Yeah, there's a lot to it.
Yeah.
Well, and after all that, I've decided to declare the If You're Listening Basement its own sovereign nation. We will be charging an excise on MP3 files leaving the nation, which means that you'll probably just have to pay a little bit for the podcast, potentially. We'll be sending you a tax bill sometime in the next financial year. Next week, we're continuing our look at the tortured relationship between Israel and Lebanon and why exactly this conflict has become the sticking point of the Iran war. I'll catch you then.